From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we call Port-au-Prince, Haiti, to talk with journalist Kathy Klarich about the crisis there. Despite rebel leader Guy Philippe's promise to disarm his troops and leave the capital, Klarich says the city is still full of men with guns. Also, a historical perspective on the situation in Haiti from journalist Amy Willens. She spent years reporting on the country, edited and translated a book by deposed leader Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and is the author of her own book, The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is on his way back to his ranch in Texas after a two-day fundraising trip to California. The president accused his presumptive opponent, John Kerry, of flip-flopping on the issues and planning to take tax cuts away so that he can increase federal spending. President Bush's first television ads for his re-election campaign are being broadcast today in select markets around the country. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The Bush campaign anticipates spending some $100 million between now and the August Republican convention on advertising. Much of that will be spent attacking the Democrats and the all-but-official nominee John Kerry. But the ads that start today take a softer tone, portraying the president as a steady leader.
What sees us through tough times? Freedom, faith, families, and sacrifice. President Bush, steady leadership in times of change.
The ads include brief images of the ruins of the World Trade Center, prompting some criticism from families of victims of the terrorist attacks and from the Firefighters Union. But the Bush campaign defends the use of such images, saying 9/11 is an event that changed the country and which demonstrates the president's leadership qualities. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Palestinian officials say the Israeli army shot and killed a 14-year-old boy today during a raid in the southern Gaza town of Rafah. The Israeli military says they were fired on and they returned fire. The Palestinians accused the Israelis of bulldozing several homes in Rafah and damaging water and electricity networks. The Israelis say they were there to search for tunnels used by Palestinians to smuggle weapons from neighboring Egypt. NPR's Peter Kenyon in Gaza City says Rafah is a frequent site of Israeli incursions.
There have been numerous raids, and there have also been attacks on soldiers in this area. And there is some indication that tunnels have been used in some of those attacks. And the tunnels come across from Egypt, and they wind up sometimes in the basements, leading up to the basement or lower floor of a house on the Palestinian side. And this is, of course, what the Israelis are concerned about. What Palestinians and some UN workers and other international officials question is the scale of the demolition.
NPR's Peter Kenyon reporting from Gaza City. Dozens of gay and lesbian couples applied for marriage licenses in New York City today and were turned away. The applications were part of a demonstration designed to gain attention for the issue. Yesterday, New York's Attorney General issued a finding saying that state law prohibits same-sex marriage because the law refers to bride and groom and husband and wife. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 5 points to close at 10,588 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 21 points to close at 2055. This is NPR News. A German appeals court has granted a retrial for Munir el-Motasadik, the only person to be convicted so far in connection with the September 11th attacks. The appeals court says Motasadik was denied access to a potentially important witness. Motasadik was a friend of the September 11th hijackers who lived in Hamburg but claimed to know nothing of their plans. The appeals court said his claims could have been supported by testimony from Ramzi bin al-Shib, who's now in U.S. custody. U.S. authorities refused to allow bin al-Shib to attend Motasadik's trial or to release transcripts of his interrogation. A prominent Chinese democracy activist has arrived in California after being released from jail in China and allowed to fly to the United States. NPR's Rob Gifford reports.
Wang Youcai was released nearly 6 years into an 11-year sentence. He'd been sentenced in 1998 for activities related to the founding of the China Democracy Party. Wang had previously been one of the student leaders of the 1989 pro-democracy demonstrations, which ended with the massacre of hundreds, perhaps thousands of people in Tiananmen Square. He'd also served time in jail after that. Activist John Kam said China is clearly taking such actions on cases considered a priority by the United States, at a time when Washington has been critical of Beijing's human rights record. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Shanghai.
The productivity of American workers rose solidly in the fourth quarter of last year, but not as much as some analysts had been expecting. The Labor Department says productivity was up by 2.4% after a gain of more than 9% during the third quarter. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Tension and uncertainty continue in the Caribbean nation of Haiti, where hundreds of armed men inhabit the capital Port-au-Prince, and the main stabilizing force at the moment is a contingent of about 2,000 U.S. Marines and international forces. After a month of political violence and chaos, Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide boarded a plane and left his country Sunday. He soon claimed he'd been forced from power, effectively kidnapped by the United States. Secretary of State Colin Powell called the accusation absurd, but some Democrats in Congress have taken up Aristide's cause. Meanwhile, the political future of Haiti is anything but clear. For a closer look at the crisis, we called Kathy Klarich, who's covered the country for two decades and is reporting on the current conflict for Time magazine and the Christian Science Monitor. I spoke to her this morning from Port-au-Prince. What's the feeling in the streets? Do you feel comfortable getting out and about?
I have to tell you, it's a very strange period right now in the streets. I think everybody is concerned. There are still a tremendous number of guns around, and all different sides have them. You've got the Haitian National Police, who up until last week were supposed to be protecting President Aristide. They've now joined forces with what we don't even really know what to call them. First they called them thugs, then they called them insurgents. They never wanted to sort of formalize them by calling them rebels because they said rebels would have a cause. But this group from the north that was led by a former Haitian military police officer named Guy Philippe, the Haitian National Police joined forces with this group, with Philippe's group called the Front. They have a tremendous number of guns. Aristide's supporters still have a tremendous number of guns. So it's not quite clear who's got the guns, but they're all over the place.
Guy Philippe was reported to have said yesterday that he and his followers would lay down their arms and support a transition to civilian authority. Does it look like they're doing that?
They did announce yesterday that they would keep their word, which was that when President Aristide leaves, they would lay down their guns. This contradicts a statement that they made on Tuesday when he declared himself the head of the armed forces. I think he was muscle-armed quite strongly by some very top-level people. He did put down his guns. He said he's returning back to the north today with his troops. I think the concern is that he may be leaving Port-au-Prince, but the men that follow him, the guns that they have, those are not going to disappear.
To what extent is he a leader of a genuine national movement? And one piece I read said he had maybe 60 followers. Clearly, there are a lot more people active than that.
Well, this is also sort of up for grabs. When he came into Port-au-Prince on Monday, the reception that he got in Port-au-Prince was actually quite astounding. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of people that gathered around the street to greet him. Some of his men had come in the day before. He allegedly had sort of sleeper cells already in the Capitol waiting for his arrival, waiting for President Aristide to leave. I think he has, it's very hard to say, 300, 400, 500, I don't know, but that's the core group. In addition to that, he has many men who were in the military that Aristide disbanded back in 1995. Many of those people were very angry. They never received their pension. They never turned back their weapons. They kept their badge. So when Guy Philippe appeared in the Capitol on Monday, they saw a chance for them to resume a position that they felt had illegally been taken away from them. There used to be 7,000 in the Haitian military, so that's another element of uncertainty, where these people are and what their allegiance is.
Tell us a little about Guy Philippe himself.
Guy Philippe is an interesting guy. He was trained in Ecuador. He's part of a group of 10 they call the Latinos. He was police chief of a local section in Port-au-Prince called Delma, and then he was the police chief up in Cape Haitien, which is the second largest city up in the north. During his period up in the north, drug trafficking, which has been a problem in this country for many years, flourished. And I know personally, having seen documents, that he was under investigation by the United States and by the Haitian government for drug trafficking. He's a very personable, charismatic guy. He's good-looking in his 30s, very media-savvy. And because he's a very charismatic and bright guy, he sort of became a folk hero overnight because, in fact, he did liberate the capital, in parentheses, I'd say liberate, the capital from terror that the people had been living under for the last few weeks intensely, in the last several years, I think, less so. Port-au-Prince last week was extremely scary because there was so much uncertainty and terror and guns and shooting and looting. And when Guy Philippe came, he rides in on the top of an SUV, and honestly, it was like, you know, God had descended down into Port-au-Prince.
Tell us a little more about the conditions last week when there was so much fear and uncertainty. Who was perpetrating the violence?
Last week, the violence was perpetrated mostly by gangs, I think loosely formed gangs that they call chimère here, which is the Creole word for this fire-breathing mythical monster. They were extremely well-armed. They worked in concert with some, not all, elements of the police and Aristide's own security. But the end result was that you were really terrified to go out on the streets. I myself had several extremely unpleasant incidents. There were spontaneous roadblocks. People's cars were stolen. Their cars were smashed. Buildings were looted, people were robbed. It was general chaos and anarchy with a level of terror that I hadn't experienced for at least 10, 12 years during the coup period when we had some really bad days like that. But this to me came as a complete surprise because I hadn't expected the situation to deteriorate so quickly.
You mentioned you'd had a number of troubling incidents yourself. Describe one of those occasions for us.
Well, I'll describe two different days. One day was when we were trying to get home from the airport, from St. Mark. We'd driven up to St. Mark, which is about 2 hours from here. We were on our way to Gonaïves, and we hit a roadblock that was put up by the Haitian police and the people in St. Mark. St. Mark was an Aristide-friendly town. Gonaïves was an anti-Aristide town. And they had blocked off access to the north because they were worried that the rebels were going to come in. So we turned around and came back to the city. But the city itself had also gotten rumors that the rebels were going to come. So they set up roadblocks everywhere. And we must have had to navigate, without exaggerating, about a dozen. And every time we got to one, we had to explain that we were journalists, that we just wanted to get back to Port-au-Prince, that we had no political agenda. But they were a little bit out of control. And I think the scariest part about that kind of situation is that you've got relatively young guys, heavily armed, with no real leader. And so it's sort of like a loose cannon. We eventually navigated the most difficult roadblock by having about 12 of these guys climb all over our car on top, in front, and hanging off the back. They wanted a ride somewhere, and so they got us through several of the next barricades so that we could eventually come back. That was earlier in the week. On Friday, which I think everyone here would say was really sort of the turning point for how bad things got, we were stopped twice as we went out, once by a young kid who had a gun in his hand who basically just wanted money from us, and another group who I think might have taken our car, except that a second car in this loosely knit gang came up and said, oh, let him go, let him go. I do know that other journalists had their cars smashed and some of them had them stolen.
You described Guy Philippe as a charismatic, media-savvy leader. The State Department said earlier this week that the rebels would play no role in Haiti's political process in the future. Do you believe Guy Philippe will go along with that? He sounds like a guy with ambitions.
Well, he was pretty contrite yesterday at this press conference. Before this, he's been speaking in English. He speaks English, he speaks Spanish, and obviously Creole and French. He gave the press conference in Creole. There were a lot of foreign media there, and he refused to answer any questions in English. It was pretty clear that he'd been heavy, you know, the word had come down pretty heavy-handed, you're going to play by our rules. But as I said, he's not going to disappear. I think in his own mind, he's expecting that the army will come back or that he will play some role in a new security force. And I think that's partly why he's going to go back up to the north. He's going to lay low for a little while. But I would be really surprised if he's going to disappear.
You don't think he wants to be the next president?
I might have thought that on Monday and Tuesday. When I saw his behavior yesterday, I realized someone had gotten to him. I think that there might be some carrot and stick. I mean, they may have said to him, look it, unless you lay low, we're going to indict you on drug trafficking charges, or we're going to, I'm not quite sure exactly what threat that they used, but they may have said further down the line, let's see how this plays out.
And who would the they be here? I mean, the impression is of a country that's sort of lawless and out of control. Who would be giving him the word?
Well, I don't have any confirmation on this, although people have been reporting it, that we now have a new commander for the U.S. Marines that have entered, and it is that colonel that spoke directly with him. He was seen going into the U.S. ambassador's residence and left 20 minutes later, but reports say that he, in fact, did not speak with the U.S. ambassador.
We're speaking with Time Magazine's correspondent in Haiti, Kathy Klarich. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kathy Klarich from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. She is Time Magazine's correspondent in Haiti. In one of your pieces, you mentioned a gentleman, Donny Toussaint, I believe was the name, as a potential player in the new order. Who is he? Why is he important?
Donny Toussaint is actually an extremely important player, and I think a name that we're going to hear more of as this whole process plays out. He was a very close friend and security bodyguard, actually, for President Aristide. He was with him when Aristide went into exile the first time in 1991. He came back and led the new police force back in 1994. But he also is extremely ambitious, charismatic, very bright guy. He ran for senator on the same party that President Aristide came into power with, the Lavalas Party. But he eventually split with him, and the real split came sometime last year. He's been an outspoken critic of President Aristide. He has his own men that are sort of his gang that are quite loyal to him. He boasts that he can, that he could take back the city within a matter of hours and restore order. He has been out quite a bit the last few days with his own security people trying to keep calm in the city. But I think he told us last week that he didn't dismiss the idea of being president, but he did say it's not the right time yet.
You write that he was investigated by Haitian and U.S. officials for crimes ranging from assassination of Aristide opponents to narcotics trafficking.
Yes, he was investigated back in 1994. 94, I think, or 95, for an outspoken Haitian lawyer, Mireille du Rocher Bertin. He was never charged with that assassination. He's also been investigated for drug trafficking charges. There are certainly lots of rumors that fly all over the country here about his involvement with drug trafficking. But again, he's never been indicted.
So it sounds as if there are the beginnings of some stability, at least in the capital and throughout the country. Does anyone have an idea what will happen in terms of choosing the next government for Haiti?
Well, there is a process in place. Again, this is all very confusing because before President Aristide went into exile, there was a constitutional crisis because the parliament, which needed to be, there needed to be more people elected, elections were never held, so their terms expired. So all of the lower chamber, they are not in session, and only two-thirds of the senators actually currently hold office. The process when a president goes into exile, like what happened with Aristide this week, is that the president of the Supreme Court takes over. His position has to be ratified by the parliament. Hence, there's a constitutional crisis because there's no parliament to ratify the new president's position. Yvonne Neptune, who was Aristide's prime minister, appointed a judge the morning that Aristide left, and that judge ratified the new president. Whether or not that was legal, I think, is certainly questionable for a lot of people here. The next step, according to an agreement that was presented even before Aristide left, is to name a three-party commission. There will be a member of the United Nations Development Program, a member of the former Lavalas government, and someone nominated by a group of businessmen and human rights leaders. That group is supposed to name what's called a Council of Wise Men. It will be seven men from different sectors throughout the country. Those men, in turn, will name a prime minister, and then that prime minister will name a cabinet. So you can see it's a very long, very complicated process, and all along the way, I think there will be questions about its legality from the get-go of naming of swearing in of this new president.
Kathy, there are American troops on the ground in Port-au-Prince. How do Haitians regard the Marines? What's your sense of the reaction on the street to seeing American troops patrolling?
Well, you know, it's pretty interesting. I was here in 1994 when about 23,000 U.S. troops brought President Aristide back, and the feeling then was just sort of like absolute delight. You know, they were crawling all over the cars and the tanks and making friends with the Marines. I mean, they were so happy that the troops were here. This time, they're a lot more cautious. I think there is a lot of resentment that when the military, the international troops came in 10 years ago, they didn't do very much for the country. They left, and then we went through this very long period here of instability and high crime and decline in the economic situation. So they're not nearly as receptive. I think there's also a lot of resentment that they couldn't quite figure it out themselves, and that, again, they needed foreign troops to come back and restore order.
If Guy Philippe's troops or the followers of the deposed President Aristide get active again and start shooting people, if looting recurs, are the international troops prepared to intervene on the streets of Port-au-Prince and stop it?
Well, when we talked to the U.S. Marines here, what they said is if we're shot at, we will respond in kind. I think that their mandate is going to shift and shift relatively quickly to make sure that what they're calling the friction points are calmed down. I mean, an example of this is yesterday. We went to the American embassy. There were certainly Marines present. And when we left the embassy, we went a couple blocks. We wanted to go to the northern part of the town. And there were roadblocks set up, and there was a lot of shooting, and we couldn't go through. So we pulled back, and there was a car that pulled out from the embassy, you know, a few minutes behind us. They did the same thing. They went up. They saw that there was a roadblock. They saw there were people with guns that were shooting. They turned around and went back. Now, they were probably on a reconnaissance, and they probably reported to the Marines that this is a hot spot, but The Marines are patrolling. They're not actually going in and disarming.
What role do you think U.S. forces or international forces should play there? Should they actually seek out and arrest and try people who've been guilty of abuses, atrocities?
Well, I there are two different issues, I think, seeking out and then trying. Just to stick on the line of the judicial system for a second, it's fraught with problems. People have historically been able to buy their judgment, and this has happened almost across the board in all the towns in Haiti. Over the last several weeks, all the prisons have been broken into and prisoners have been released. So actually trying someone, convicting them, and putting them away has been historically almost, I mean, it just doesn't really happen. What role should the United States or other countries play? I think they need to make a long-term commitment to building state institutions and developing a security force. When the Prime Minister was asked yesterday how he felt about reinstituting the army, he said, "That's not our job to decide. We should put it back to the Haitian people. There is a proposal on the floor of the legislative body. When it comes back, it will be able to vote on it, and that will depend on who it is that the people elect. If they elect someone that they think is going to vote for it, then it's possible that the army will be reinstated. But if it is reinstated, I think we need to be very careful about what its mandate is, because historically the Haitian army has done nothing but protect those with money and power.
In fostering the growth of the kinds of institutions that you describe, I mean, does that mean that foreign troops occupy the country? Do they give training to a new police force and civil service? How does that work, do you think?
I think that they need to work hand in hand in training and developing a police force, and then giving them the tools that they need to make sure that there are enough resources and a long-term commitment so that these men feel that they're being paid properly, they have the tools to do their work, that there is a hierarchy that is not only installed but respected. And then add to this mix, there has to be a real clean sweep of the drug trafficking, which has taken over a great deal of the, I mean, it's infiltrated the police institutions, the state institutions, and gone basically unchecked over much of the northern part of the country.
Journalist Kathy Klarich, who's covering the conflict in Haiti for Time Magazine and the Christian Science Monitor. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. By audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. And from TIAA Cref, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Kathy Klarich, who's currently in Port-au-Prince. Also, a look at Haiti through its turbulent history, from slave uprisings to American occupation. We'll speak with journalist Amy Willens. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with correspondent Kathy Klarich, who's covering the conflict in Haiti for Time magazine and the Christian Science Monitor. Tension continues in the Caribbean nation following the departure of the country's president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Sunday after a month of escalating violence. Klarich spoke to us this morning from Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. President Aristide has said since he was deposed that he was effectively kidnapped by U.S. authorities and forced out of power, and he's gotten a lot of attention from supporters in the Congressional Black Caucus in Washington. They had a mocking encounter with some State Department officials yesterday. What's your sense of President Aristide's charges that he was the victim of an American coup d'etat?
Well, I think what may be true is that he also was strong-armed into making this decision and not one that he wanted to make. We spoke with a representative from the U.S. government here, the Deputy Chief of Staff, who rarely speaks to the press and certainly not on record, and was very clear in saying that he went to President Aristide's house, he met with him, his bags were packed, he got in the car, he handed over the letter of resignation. He seemed resigned to the fact that this was going to happen. His wife was sullen, but there was, it just, from his perspective, there was absolutely no coercion. He got on the plane willingly. I think that it's also in President Aristide's interest to say that because he doesn't want his supporters to feel that he abandoned them. I did speak with some members of his government, and they said that they were surprised and felt that it was a big disappointment and a deception. So I think he was muscled into going, but I think he boxed himself into a corner and in the end realized that that was the only choice that he had left.
He's saying he wants to come back. Do you see that happening? What would be the reaction if he did?
It's very interesting. They're calling for him to come back because they want to judge him. I think the vast majority of people, at least at this point, would not be particularly happy to see him, and those that are would be ones who would want to take him to court.
You know, I'm curious your sense of the attitude of people in Haiti's many, many poor neighborhoods who have seen 15 years of political violence now. I wonder if a cynicism sets in, whether they even care who occupies the National Palace anymore.
You know, I think it's a really good point. And having watched this transition in Haiti for now about, nearly 20 years, it's very sad to me that there is very little sense of hope. And every time there's been a change of government, and there's been many since I've been watching Haiti's political situation, there was a feeling that maybe this time we're going to get it right. There's a little bit of that hope in the more educated people who have been watching the various groups negotiate, because you do have some human rights groups, you have some business people that are involved in a way that they hadn't been before. But the question you ask about the really poor, do they care? I think not. I think what they are so desperate to have is running water, electricity, roads, schools, and for them, none of that has changed at all. In fact, it's gotten much worse.
Does this generate more refugees hoping to flee to the United States?
Well, that's also an interesting question. I have talked to people in the boat-building communities. Part of the factor that influences that is economics, and the Haitian, the dollar, their gourd, has so devalued over the years, and so little money has come in that they don't even have the money to build the boats, let alone take the voyage. I think that's in large part why we haven't seen the masses taking to the small boats and hoping to get to Florida like we have seen in the past. Not to say that it won't happen, but I think by and large it's an economic situation, and also the message that the U.S. government has been pounding for the last couple of years is that we are not going to let you stay once you get here, so don't try to come.
Has American policy towards Haitian refugees changed since the September 11th attacks?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the crackdown on the Haitian refugees is completely different than what they use for people coming from other countries. It changed I have to get my dates right. I think there was a boatload that came in December of 2001 and then another one that came in October of 2002 that had several hundred Haitian refugees on it. normally when you reach shore, which both of these boats did, you are given what's called a credible fear of asylum interview. And if you pass that, then you're allowed to be out in, not in detention, to work on gathering material to present your case to an immigration judge. Well, that policy changed, and it was not made public for many months, where Haitians were no longer allowed to be released once they passed their credible fear. They had to remain in detention to prepare their case. And that's an incredible hardship because they don't have access to the resources or the legal staff that they need to properly prepare their case. They've been in what's called expedited removal, which means that their period of time to be able to present their case is shortened. So they have been discriminated against. And for me, the most ironic thing is that Haitians who are in detention now are being deported back to Haiti and have been deported back these last 3 weeks when almost all of the other countries that have people in the United foreigners in Haiti are asking that they evacuate because the situation is so unstable.
There's a fairly significant Haitian community in the United States, a lot of them in Florida. Do you have a sense of who they support in this?
That's also been a very tricky question. I know, living in Miami and watching the Haitian community, their sense of reality in the States is actually quite different than what's happening here. I think you've got a whole group of people who are still loyal to Duvalier and have been waiting for years for him to come back. You have a vast number of people who believe that the democratic process was interrupted the first time with the coup in 1991, and will feel now again that the democratic process was interrupted by the United States plucking Aristide out. On the other hand, you've got a lot of people who realize how tenuous and just unbearable the situation has been here, and that the only solution was to remove Aristide.
There's a very strong Cuban-American community in Florida and throughout the country that has a lot of political weight, obviously the legacy of Castro's takeover. I'm wondering, how much clout does the Haitian-American community wield?
It certainly does not have the same weight that the Cuban community does. In Miami, however, they are starting to realize that that's an important part of their community that they need to develop. So we now have more elected officials than we have ever had. I think one of the big problems is that it is a divided community. And just like Haiti, it's sort of a microcosm of things that go wrong, where you get a group of people together that can't agree ideologically, and so they're not able to create a power base. I'm hoping that will change. President Aristide is gone. There is almost no chance of him coming back. So that now it's a time for those groups to work together and figure out what it is that they want and then start lobbying for it. I think it's imperative that they have a presence in the United States Congress so that they can make their voice heard about what kind of a relationship they want the U.S. to have with Haiti, and that the commitment now become more instituted and less of a sort of a response to a crisis situation.
You've spent a lot of years in Haiti. Give us just a little sense of kind of your own state, having endured what you have over the past month. Are you frightened, sleep deprived, exhausted?
Oh, I'm exhausted. Sleep deprived, I guess, because you don't sleep well. There's been so much tension. I love Haiti. I would move back here in a second, actually. I know that that's still the horror of most people who know me, but I'm living with my son in the States, and that's where he prefers to be right now. There's some real charm about Haiti that I think gets lost in all of his talks about the political situation and the violence. It's a wonderful country. It's a wonderful people. They talk about things that are important. They've got their priorities right. There is a sense of community that I think is irreplaceable, but it is a very difficult place to live.
Well, Kathy Claritch, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Journalist Kathy Claritch, who's covering the crisis in Haiti for Time Magazine and the Christian Science Monitor. I spoke to her this morning from Port-au-Prince. Coming up, a look at Haiti's troubled history with writer Amy Willens. This is Fresh Air. Jean-Bertrand Aristide's departure from Haiti on Sunday marks the 33rd time a government has been overthrown in that Caribbean nation. For a perspective on Haiti's history of political upheaval, we spoke to journalist Amy Willens, who's written widely in the country and is the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. She also edited and translated Aristide's 1990 book, In the Parish of the Poor, Writings from Haiti. Willens has written for The New Yorker and other publications and is currently a contributing editor at The Nation. I asked her about the slave uprising 200 years ago in which Haiti won its independence from France.
Haiti was the richest colony of the French and a huge producer of sugar. The slave population outnumbered the planter population by something like 20 times. There were hundreds of thousands of slaves and thousands of planters. And it was an extremely brutal colonial regime, and the slaveholders was one of the most brutal of all the slaveholding colonies. Eventually, in 1791, it began, and there was a slave revolt, sealed in blood at midnight during a vodou ceremony in the countryside. Some slaves rose to power among the revolutionaries, and it was the time of the French Revolution, so it was a heady time for people who wanted liberty in the world anyway. And it was a French colony, so the slaves heard about liberty and fraternity and equality. They drove out the planters in a very cruel revolt in which people were brutally massacred. And, of course, it poisoned the relationship between Haiti and France, I would say, forever. The French eventually, when they were ousted, demanded reparations from the Haitians for the plantations destroyed, etc. I think it's one of the few cases in history I know of where the loser got reparations from the victor. But they did. They got millions of francs, I believe, and that would be a huge amount of money right now, and that the Haitian government under Aristide was asking to have returned to Haiti. So there you go. The history of the revolution still alive in Haiti today.
And what was France's response? What's its relationship with Haiti today?
Well, right now it's, the French were the first to call for Aristide to resign. And I think one of the reasons is that slap in the face from Aristide asking for what are billions of dollars now in reparations returned to the Haitian government. During the first coup d'etat against Aristide, the French sort of helped get him out of the country alive. But this time I think there was no love lost. And the French have their embassy there just like the Americans, and they have a troubled relationship with the Haitians.
You've written often that it's a country without institutions. Is this a product of its early liberation from colonial rule? How do you think that shaped the way Haiti developed as a society?
I think Haitians have a cultural mistrust of institutions. First of all, the earliest institution they knew was slavery, the child of a greater institution, colonialization. And so their whole history was essentially a revolt against an institution. Institutions are generally seen by Haitians as coming from the outside, and Haitians are mistrustful of foreigners because they don't want to be occupied or colonized again. And I think that's really what it comes from. And then there is this ability. It's sort of a fluid society. I've written that it's the system of no system. When there's no system, then it's more organic, and there are these big men and the families around them and then the larger communities. And there's a tradition of cooperative workforces among them that comes from slave times. And it can work, but someone has to impose order.
There's a well-known Haitian martyr, Charlemagne Peyral, who was a victim of the United States Marines. When did the United States Marines intervene in Haiti, and what was the legacy?
The U.S. Marines came into Haiti in 1915 and remained for almost two decades. During that time, they did some good things. They built a lot of roads. Haiti's infrastructure is still sort of the legacy of the Marine occupation. But they were also very controlling of the Haitians, very dismissive of the Haitians, and basically, ran the country entirely. And eventually there was a revolt in the countryside, which was a special thing because most of the politics of Haiti comes from Port-au-Prince, the capital. And if you run the capital, you can effectively run the politics of the country. And that's what the Americans counted on. And they ran Port-au-Prince and therefore the nation. But there was a peasant revolt led by Charlemagne Peyrade. And he ran bunches of peasants who would attack the Marines and other institutions of, you know, control, planters, cultivators. And his revolt was finally put down, and he was entrapped and assassinated by the Marines. And then his body was sort of crucified on a board or a door, and he was photographed, and that photograph was distributed among the Haitians so they could see that this guy had been killed. And in fact, there's a very famous Haitian painting of the body of Charlemagne Peyrade.
And when people see American Marines in Port-au-Prince today, does that image return?
That image returns, the idea of their humiliation under the American occupation. I mean, there are a lot of Haitians who understand that there some good came out of the occupation, but mostly it's seen as a national humiliation. You have to understand that a people who threw off the yoke of the French colonial system and the army of Napoleon in the late 1700s and early 1800s are very sensitive about their national sovereignty.
Well, let's talk about the deposed president, who you know so well, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Mm-hmm. He was a priest when the Duvalier family was controlling Haiti. How did he become so widely known among his countrymen?
Well, he was unfailingly courageous and extremely eloquent in Creole, and his parish was in a slum right at the edge of Port-au-Prince, and so it was a very populous area. And the people who had come to see him preach were people from this slum called La Saline, and he would preach these incredible sort of metaphoric sermons against the Duvalierists, and that led to his being more widely known, first in Port-au-Prince and then throughout the country.
He was widely celebrated for his actions on the day of a massive demonstration at the Army facility. Was it Fort Dimanche? Do I have that name right?
Yes, it's an old prison run by the Army.
What did he do that day that earned him such a reputation?
He stood while bullets were flying and people were actually being killed. The army was shooting into a crowd of demonstrators. He stood there with a microphone in his hand, and he was broadcasting on Radio Soleil, Sunshine Radio, which was the station of the Catholic Church and very important at the time in the resistance to Duvalier. And while the bullets were whizzing around him, he kept on broadcasting in his own eloquent Creole from the actual scene of a massacre. So that got him some repute also.
Of course, he was elected and then deposed 7 months later in a military coup. And right. he became well acquainted with many in the United States because he campaigned for a return to power. And you were there in 1994 when, accompanied by U.S. helicopters, I believe, he returned to Port-au-Prince and resumed power. Aristide, of course, had seen him. He'd seen his power upset by a military uprising. What did he do to prevent that from happening again?
Well, when he came back, that was 1994. By 1995, he had disbanded the Haitian army, and it was a brave thing to do. I think it was also revenge. I mean, he was very angry at them for overthrowing him. They had tried to do it several times before they did it. He had been their victim as a priest in assassination attempts, and he wanted to get rid of them. In retrospect, I think it was a dangerous thing to do, and that seduction and bribery would have been a wiser path in dealing with the Haitian army.
My guest is journalist Amy Willens. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Amy Willens, who's written widely about Haiti. Her book is called The Rainy Season. You wrote, when you were talking about this pattern of violence and retribution, doing and undoing is what Haitian politics is about. It's one of the reasons Haitians rarely describe political activity as a continual movement forward, but rather as a process of correcting the mistakes of the past. Do you see any way out of that?
That's why Aristide should have remained in power in spite of his flaws, because until you can have the peaceful transfer of power, you cannot have a long-term process in which institutions can be built. If the people who come to power now are not going to continually transfer power peacefully to other groups who are legitimately elected in a democratic process, who's to say that whatever institution they begin to build now is not going to be déchouqued, you know, in 3 years? And then where will the Haitian people be again? Who's going to resort to a justice system that is corrupt and will no longer be there, you know, by the time the trial is finished? It just will not work. There has to be a process. And whether or not the United States likes the person who's the president, or whether or not the Haitian elite likes him, the president has to be left in power.
I wonder if you see any parallels between the period right now in Haiti, where a president has been deposed, and the time in the 80s when you were there, when Jean-Claude Duvalier, the dictator for many years, had been deposed.
Oh, for me, this is the worst part, is that seeing Aristide deposed, who I've known for so long and whom I really respected, especially at the beginning of his tenure, and to see the Haitian people behaving the same toward him after his ouster as they behaved toward Jean-Claude Duvalier, it's very shocking to me. And, you know, leads me to suspect all my intuitions from back in the old days when Duvalier left. The déchoucage, the uprooting of all of Duvalier's goods and all of his family's houses, it's happening to Aristide's houses. And, you know, I know that my book, The Rainy Season, was in Aristide's house that was just déchouqued. And they took out all the books, and people were paging through the books and throwing the family's photographs around. And I'm thinking, you know, my stupid book was in that house saying that Aristide could be a great thing for Haiti. And now look, it's quite heartbreaking.
Aristide reportedly told a number of people, including U.S. Congress people, that he was effectively kidnapped by the Americans and removed from power. You know him well. Does that sound credible to you?
You say effectively kidnapped. I believe that's the key word. He's speaking hyperbolically and metaphorically. What I think happened was that he was surrounded by people with arms. He remembered very clearly the first time there was a coup d'etat in which his life was actually threatened in 1991. And it seemed like that to him. And then he was hustled off in the middle of the night onto a plane and didn't know where he was going and was not told where he was being taken. So that felt a lot like kidnapping to him. And I think he uses the word metaphorically, but I think it was an ill-advised thing to say immediately. But, you know, he must have felt it very strongly. And to be carted off to the Central African Republic is really an indignity I'm not sure he should have been forced to suffer.
Yeah, certainly a long way from where he'd come. But he seemed to be saying that he never made the decision to step down.
Yeah, I think he made a decision to step down, but then it was taken out of his hands, and the timing of it was taken out of his hands, and it sounds as if the resignation letter was coerced in the sense that unless he provided it, he would not be guaranteed a safe exit. You know, he was sitting in the car at the airport, and this is from the State Department now in the New York Times, and he was being asked for that letter, the implication being, unless you give us a letter acknowledging you're resigning, we are not taking you out, and if we don't take you out, you're going to be dead.
Was Aristide, the Aristide who was president, do you believe he was the same man that you knew when he was an insurgent priest? Do you recognize him?
I recognize him, but one thing that happened to him was that when you're in opposition, you can be very, very eloquent, and you can say what you think, and you can lead in a sort of unambivalent, unambiguous way. But once you're president, you're supposedly president of all of Haiti, you have enemies who are very powerful, You can't simply promote your friends. And one of the things that happened to Aristide was it was as if his Creole tongue had been cut out. You know, you just didn't hear him saying the kinds of important liberty-loving things that he had said as a free operative before he became president. Also, he began to deal a lot with the international media with whom he spoke in English, and his English is simply not as good as his French or his Creole or his Spanish. And so that made him seem less powerful and less committed to his earlier constituency. And I think the Haitian people felt that too. I think they felt removed from him and as if he were grander. And in part, they feel that a president should be important and should have certain things, but they wanted to feel that he was special and especially their president. And it was harder for him to do that once he was in the presidential palace.
Well, Amy Willens, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Journalist Amy Willens. Her book is The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Emperor, The Death of Kings, a novel about Julius Caesar's rise to power by Con Iggulden, author of Emperor, The Gates of Rome. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, contemporary artist Chuck Close. He's known for his larger-than-life paintings of the human face. A retrospective of his print work is now on exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Join us for the next Fresh Air.